sentence.
She went to the
theater. Oh, yeah. And so that she had to go into work in the field, as did so many of the others. And that was their life. Now I want to give you an idea, in addition to which, of course, I don't know why I say of course, because I know it, and maybe people of my age, my generation, where they came from, know it doesn't necessarily mean that you know it. At that time, the Ukraine was divided between two large countries, Russia, Tsarist Russia at that time, and what was known as the Austro-Hungarian Empire. This is prior to World War I. It's well worth to remember, because that World War I played a great influence in the lives of people over there and those that came over here. And I have to come from what's known as Western Ukraine, which was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But the Austro-Hungarian Empire was also subdivided, and where there was a large nationality group, that was a predominant group, and they were able to occupy positions of importance, because in order to keep a great peoples conquered and subdued, you know the old theory of divide and conquer. So they had discrimination. The Poles, because we were very close to Poland, Poles had a history of feudal landlords and Polish pawns, they were called. They occupied many overseer's positions, as did Austrians and Germans. And in other parts of the country, Hungarians. So there was a great deal of animosity, and much of it was fostered. Certainly no one took any pains to educate the people that just because you happen to speak Polish, or you speak German, or you speak Austrian, or you speak Bulgarian, if the only difference is language, but that you're all people and should respect each other. On the contrary, these things were used to pit one group against the other. A great deal of anti-Semitism came into being that way. Because just in passing, the Jews were not permitted to own land. The Jews could not work in certain kinds of industrial establishments. But the Jews were permitted to maintain small stores or taverns. So in our village, whatever little store wanted you could buy some salt and some matches and liquor was owned by a Jew. Therefore, the poor land, poor peasant, could turn his animosity to the one who was closest to him that he felt was taking advantage of. He took it out on the Jew. And those are the ways in which anti-Semitism was planted. Sure, other people will say, well, look, he's the one who's doing it. He's the one who's doing it. Plus spreading all kinds of false stories about their religion, their background. And this is the way hatred was nurtured, one group against the other. I mention that only because some of the people who left didn't want to return, therefore just expressing these purposes. So in addition to being discriminated against, many schools were closed to people. One of the finest poets and writers of Western Ukraine, his name was Ivan Franko, went to Vienna and was able to complete the university there. But when he came back to the city of Lvov, which is a central city of Western Ukraine, the Polish regent of the university there denied him the right to teach at this university, solely because he was a Ukrainian, he was highly qualified, in spite of the fact that the overwhelming majority, 8 million of the people living there, were Ukrainians. Right now, I have to say that university in which he was denied the right to teach bears his name, the Ivan Franko University in Lvov. Well, this is a story or the picture of the people over there, and I want to give you that why they were ready then. People who never heard of America, who never knew of the war, that expansive war called the Atlantic Ocean, didn't mean a thing to them. And remember, it took them 24 to 31 days to cross the ocean in steerage. Do any of you know what steerage means? Right now, they only transport cattle that way. That's the time that, at that time, they transported humans. Which meant that in the hold of the ship, in tiers, there'd be six, one above the other, with no bedding whatsoever, you had to bring your own bedding. That's where you were able to sleep, in the big hold with about 100, 125, 130 people. Children, men, and women, all together. because they felt that they were only one step above chattel, and this was certainly good enough manner in which to transport them over here. You had to take your own food with you because you didn't have enough money to buy the food on board ship. So you had to take money of the kind of food that would last. You would take your own bedding with you. And my mother, this was 50 years ago, my mother brought pillows with her that she still has. Of course, they were very big when she brought them. From one pillow, she eventually made four. So she still has the pillows that she brought with her, and one of the pillows she has given to me, and it was one of those pillows I had. And it's a better pillow than you can pick up these days around here now. So they would carry all this in bundles. They didn't know the language. You were picked up in wagons in your village, taken to the nearest city then, where you were tagged. That tag never came off your person until you landed at Ellis Island, what they call Castle Garden, if you ever heard that term, in New York City. You didn't know the language, and that was the only way. There was a little envelope in there, and all the information was on there for people connected with the transport to know where you were going and how to get you there. You were taking the largest big city, placed on a train. The train took us to Hamburg, Germany, the port. They were placed on board ship, and 24 days later, we arrived at New York City. And I remember that because we were at Ellis Island, and because we had to be processed as everybody else was processed. They did do some things to entertain children. And the reason that I remember it, I have a picture, it's not overly clear, but I have a picture of that first day at Ellis Island, is that because a man gave me something and he dropped it in front of me and the darn thing bounced. It's the first time I ever had seen a rubber ball. Beautiful red, and it bounced and I couldn't get over it, right? Wouldn't stand still. Because the only ball I had up to that was a rock. So, and I remember the train ride, because it was going so much faster than the train I went. Plus I was getting excited that I was going to see my father. And we arrived in Taylor, Pennsylvania then. And when I first saw my father, I ran as fast as I could run from him. Because he was a coal miner, he had just come home from work, and he was black as a coal miner can be. And that's where we settled. And the next thing I wanted to tell you about, and I think we have time to start it today, is the towns to which they came and what were the conditions of work there. If we want to stop, no, you want to stop it for a second moment. Yeah, this might be a good place to talk about their cultural activities. It goes without saying that I did not discuss their life over there in its entirety. There were important sections on which I didn't touch because I felt that they did not have direct bearing on the subject that you're studying and that we're working on. But sure, they were a religious people, and I didn't touch on the role that the church played. And unfortunately, in that part of the world, the church played a very negative kind of a role. It worked completely side by side and was a right-hand man of the people who were the oppressors. And that is one of the reasons why a revolution could take and did take place in a country like Tsarist Russia, a very backward country, but nevertheless it did have a revolution, whereas all philosophers and students of society predicted that a revolution would take in a highly industrialized state where the working class as such would take the lead. And yet the first revolution occurred in a country that was as backward in its time as any other country on the face of the earth. And one of the reasons, not a very small one, one of the very important ones, was a kind of a role that the church played in the life of the people. Because they were different, deeply religious people. This aroused them. On the contrary, in Poland, it was an entirely different story, and sometimes if you're ever interested, I'd like to come and talk to you about that too. Why I find very fascinating when I visit Poland to look very closely there on how they're building a new kind of social setup when you knew that it was a country that was 98% Catholic. But their church had played an entirely different role, and that explains many things that are taking place there. Also, people are people. There are two goals. One, probably, is that everyone seeks happiness. And what do you need to be happy? that you have good shelter, good food, and that you're dressed, clothed. These are the essentials. So these people actually were striving for this. They wanted to have a good house in which to live where they wouldn't freeze. They wanted enough food to eat so they wouldn't starve. And they wanted to get themselves dressed well enough that they could then enjoy life so much more. You see, and unless one puts down everything, a thing comes to mind about dress. Why some of them also couldn't go to school. My father could go to school in the wintertime only half days, because the other half of the day, his brother had to wear the boots. There was one pair of boots for two boys. So a half a day, one wore the boots, and the second half of the day, the other wore the boots, whether they fit him or not. They were a little too big. He still slushed with those boots to school and back. And if you want to go sleigh riding, he'd throw the boots across his back and barefoot and run like the diggers through that snow and then take it over a slide. Then he put on his boots and walked back, and he went to run again. He'd take the boots off, put them on his back, and go sliding again, barefoot. So each of people want our primary happiness and a joyful life. So in spite of all of these hardships, they had a rich cultural life. The Ukrainian people happened to be one of the peoples of the world, and I say this very objectively because one of my major studies has been folk music and folklore of various peoples, and I've studied folk songs of peoples throughout the world. One of the richest is the Ukraine, far more so than any of the other Slav groups, anyhow. But when you listen to their songs, you will hear that the predominant number of these songs are in a minor key, which is a sad key. They would sing about the hard life, but they would sing. They had gay tunes too, but a big, big proportion are in minor key. But these people strive then to bring in happiness into their life, whichever way they can, and it doesn't cost anything to sing a song. And it doesn't cost anything then, in the wintertime, to sit and embroider a blouse that when you put it on, will make you look nice and make you feel cheerful. So the things that didn't cost money, they would do. Because you say it didn't cost money. It didn't, because the shirt and blouse that she or he was wearing on his or her back was from materials that they grew on their land. They would grow the flax. They would dry it in the sun. They would then strip it. They would then, what do you call it when you make a thread out of it?
Spin it.
They would develop their own dye and dye the threads. They would weave the linen themselves on their handmade looms. All this was handmade, and then they would embroider. And sometimes if I get a chance, I'll bring some embroidery in to even have you look at it. Because you remember when you were taking up embroidery in the assembly when I spoke about some of the embroidery that people had? They would decorate their houses in that way. In every way possible to brighten up the drab life that they were leading. So therefore, they had many beautiful dances, they had many beautiful songs, which they would do and sing, and so around certain holidays, they would do a lot of singing. So that even over there, they would have choruses, they would sing in the choruses, they would learn how to harmonize. And this, all of this, they brought over here with them. And they maintain it up to now. There's a Ukrainian chorus in the city of New York, which I conduct, and I've conducted for 28 years. The chorus itself is 44 years old. Been going on continuously for 44 years, and we still sing Ukrainian folk songs, and we have a marvelous dance group of teenagers. I wish some of you could see them dance sometime, who do Ukrainian folk dances as well as folk dances of other national groups from Europe. You think that
that's fine.
All right. So they came in and settled in these communities. And I want to repeat that when I say that they settled, and these are the Ukrainians. Remember, this is typical of all other immigrants that came over here. Most of the Italian immigrants that are over here are not from northern Italy, but from southern Italy. Northern Italy was a developed, industrially developed country. Southern Italy was not. That's why most of the Italians who are over here came from southern Italy or Sicily. That's why most of the laborers, for example, why the Irish came over. They were land poor. If you remember about the potato famine, they also embroidered their potatoes. They came over here for the same reason. And they settled in the same areas. The part of the country where I live, there were three predominant nationality groups, Welsh, Irish, and Slavs, with a sprinkling of Germans. And then when these communities grew up, naturally other people from different parts of this country began to migrate there. People who wanted to open stores, or open up little industries, or could be out of the big industries. So you had certain segments of other nationality groups coming in. But primarily they were Welsh, Irish, and Slavs. The Welsh for obvious reasons. They were also very poor, but they had coal mines in Wales. They were brought over mainly because they were experienced coal miners, so they could work in the coal mines. The Irish came over because they were land poor, they were hungry all the time. They had to come over here to work too. So did the Slavs. So did the Italians. And they made up the biggest portion of the workforce in our country. You read about that the highways and the railroads were built by the Italians and the Irish. The coal was mined by the Slavs primarily, and the steel was poured by Slavs. There are communities in western Pennsylvania that to this day, 80% of the population of that community are Slavs. Now they were recruited over there and brought over here. Now, of course, they're scattered throughout the United States. Because once they remain here, once they come out of the language, once they accumulate a little bit of money, then, and they would no longer be beholden to the company that brought them over, they would migrate to other places. That's why so many Slavs settled in Detroit when the automobile industry began to open up. And it's also no accident why should so many of them leave a job when they become established and go to a new job? Because life in the coal mines was too hard, too rough. Here they came over not knowing everything was strange to them. Everything. From the climate to the food to working conditions to the language to the people with whom they associate. And very highly discriminated against. And is it all right to use as an example here the first two words that my father learned? They're not obscene, but they're swear words. The first two words my father learned was son of a bitch and bastard. And he thought they were pretty good words. That's how he was called for about 3 or 4 weeks until somebody explained to him what they were. Yes, you were just told, come on, move, you son of a bitch. This is important to know why the people would leave there afterwards. So they said, well, they got to work in there. Then two things occurred. When they made enough money, they either sent over for their family, or they sent over for a brother or a cousin. Got enough money for him to come over to work. The money that they were making here, they were highly underpaid for the job that they were doing, but still in comparison, he was able to make over this a small fortune. In the first place, when did he ever dream in his life that he could afford to buy meat every day? So the first things that they would do, these were people who knew how to live frugally. They knew how to economize. And they did economize. In the first place, there would be 6 or 8 of them living together in one little shack. Whatever they could accumulate in material things, they would send back to their families in the old country, as they called it. And that gave rise then later over there to certain wrong concepts. They had the idea that just because he could send them $1 and $1 to purchase so many things over there, that this was a land of milk and honey, and the dollars grew on trees and streets were paved with gold. Of course, they didn't know about the fact that every day, at some time of the day, that coal mine whistle would blow. Now, it had various functions, that coal mine whistle. One was to awaken the community in the morning. It would blow at 5 in the morning, blow at 5:30 in the morning, and blow at 6. But at 6 o'clock was a signal to begin working in the coal mines. 5 was to awaken. 5:30 to let you get a half hour to get to work. Believe it or not, many of the people did not have clocks. The life depended upon the life of that community, keeping time in that community, depended on that whistle and the clock that was over the borough building or city hall. No one worried too much when that whistle blew at 5 or 5:30 or 6. No one worried very much if it blew at 3:30 or 4 o'clock. And no one worried very much if it blew at 6 o'clock at night. These were all time signals. But when it blew between times, then everybody got concerned. Because that would mean that an accident occurred in the mine. And there were periods When that whistle would blow every day, which would mean that someone was either killed or badly injured. And the whistle would blow, they didn't have enough telephone calls, would bring first aid. Even the doctor then, company doctor, would come rushing to the mine when he heard that whistle because somebody had been injured. Well, the people on the other side, the old country, didn't know all of these things. All they knew was that their father or their husband or their cousin or their brother was able to send them money. And because the demand, the needs there were so very, very great, the demands kept growing on the people here. But the longer they worked here, they tried to accumulate money, they got enough money, they would purchase a steamship there for their family or a friend or a cousin. And they make all kinds of arrangements. They would bring friends over who promised them to work and pay them back the money. And that's how the thing began to snowball and grow. And how this immigration then began to grow. Until just before 1914, it had reached terrific proportion. Because the industry was developing, word was spreading, people knew friends, and they could write to friends. So there was a long and big and steady flow. And they came and settled in the communities where their friends had preceded them. That's what we're very often find. I know in the town of which I live, half the Ukrainian population came from the village from which I came. Because each kept bringing the other over. And they settled in these communities to work. Can we stop there and take it from there?
Yes. I want to ask just one question, and then maybe some of the rest will have a question. Was there any attempt?
In the first place, that movement didn't come quite so readily, neither did it come here in this country, although it was easy because this is one country and the Negro people down south knew all about the North. They knew prior to the Civil War because the escapes, Harriet Tubman, there was the Underground Railroad, the abolitionists, people were striving to escape to the North, but there was already freedom here. There was less knowledge. A peasant deep in Russia or deep Ukraine didn't know very much about a Germany or a France or a Paris. But sure, some of them were hardy souls and they figured that, what have I got to lose? I'm going to starve to death here anyhow. I'm going to go over these mountains and see what's on the other side of these mountains. And there were these efforts. And then as time went by and word of mouth, things began to filter back. Plus the fact that with the development of industry, for example, in Germany, my father